The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly with me, Adam Vaughan, editor of The Guardian's environment site. This week's show is dedicated to an extended and in-depth interview with Mike Berners-Lee and Duncan Clark on the publication of their book, The Burning Question, subtitled, We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal and Gas, So How Do We Quit? It's a hugely difficult question and one that throws up a myriad of other questions that focus on the environmental, economic, social and political consequences of our addiction and reliance on carbon-based forms of energy. The book is a sobering and insightful overview of how much carbon-based energy reserves sit below the surface of our fragile planet and why we're in deep trouble if we exploit these reserves. But to start, I asked Duncan to lay out in simple terms how much fuel is in the ground and how much can't we burn?
Well, to meet the agreed global target of not exceeding 2 degrees of global warming, then we can emit somewhere between maybe 700 and 1,500 gigatons of CO2, pretty well ever. Now, how much depends on how risky you're feeling. If you're feeling lucky, then you can release the upper end of that. If you're feeling unlucky, you better stick to the bottom end. But so that's, you know, call it 1,500 gigatons for a 50% chance of success. Now think about what we've got in the ground. So we've got around 3,000 billion tons of CO2, potential CO2, locked up in current proven oil, coal and gas reserves. Now that's the reserves which are considered both definitely that they exist, but also that they are economically viable under current conditions. So if you take all the fuel resources in the world, all the technically recoverable fuel resources, we've got probably 40,000 gigatons of CO2. Now, it has to be said, a lot of that is coal, and a lot of it is likely never to be extracted. But what's clear is that we've got at least, you know, 5 times as much as we can safely burn, and possibly more like 10 times.
I mean, the thing is, as well as the shale gas revolution we've seen in the US, shows that we will keep finding new ways and new technologies to extract this stuff, won't we?
We will, and the fascinating thing about the shale gas revolution is, you know, people think, oh, it's cutting UK emissions, cutting US emissions. But the point we make in the book is that if you actually look at how much carbon America is taking out of the ground, that actually they're taking out more carbon than ever before because they're still taking the carbon out and they're just exporting it and using the shale gas at home.
I mean, what is the burning question? The title, you know, there is a suggestion that on the subtitle is about, you know, how do we can't burn half the world's fossil fuels. You know, how do we get ourselves off them? What is the burning question?
Well, that is the burning question. Yeah. And I think the first point that the book makes is that if you look at global emissions, back over the last 150 years, they've been growing in a very predictable way, in fact, an exponential way. And nothing that's happened in the last few decades has done anything to detectably dent that curve at all. And if you look at how long we can stay on that curve for, it looks as though the temperature is going to go through the roof if we don't come off that exponential curve for the first time very soon.
Was there a bit of debate when you were writing this as to what should be the question? I mean, were the other ones edging that one out?
There were. I mean, we ended up focusing very much on, you know, how do we leave half the oil, coal, and gas in the ground, because that really gets to the nub of what needs to happen practically. But of course, that is a can of worms, because in order to get that, you need to cover a lot of ground about global geopolitics. You need to think about human psychology. You need to think about economics. You need to think about all these barriers that are in the way of leaving that fuel where it is, including the fact that it's worth trillions of dollars to its owners, and those people are going to have to write those assets off. So we put that there as a way to sum up what needs to happen practically. But in order to achieve that, there's a huge amount that we need to work our way through, which is why we wrote a whole book about it.
And just for people coming new to this debate, I mean, can you explain why 2 degrees centigrade is considered this sort of safe level? I use that in big quote marks, and why you describe these fossil fuels as unburnable?
Sure. So the basic thing to understand is that 2 degrees is actually a fairly arbitrary cutoff point, but it's what the world's nations have agreed as a limit to the global warming that we consider acceptable. So this took about 20 years to go from the process at the beginning of the 1990s of saying that we're going to avoid dangerous interference to the climate to actually pinning a number on it, which is we're not going to let the temperature go up by more than 2 degrees. If you follow back where that 2 degrees figure comes from, it's partly political, it's partly based on science that developed in the 1990s. And actually a lot of people now, including some very eminent climate scientists, think that that level is a prescription for disaster, to use Jim Hansen's phrase. And so it's not by any means a safe level, actually, but it's the level that, for one reason or another, we've ended up with as our target. The problem is that even though that's quite a risky target, the amount of warming that we have goes up with the total amount of fossil fuel we burn, basically. And the amount of fuel left in the ground is enough to blast us not just to 2 degrees, but to 3 degrees, 4 degrees, 5, 6. No one really knows, but far beyond the agreed target. So the unavoidable implication is if you don't want to go much over 2 degrees, you're going to have to leave most of that fuel in the ground.
Hence unburnable. Yeah. And I mean, you talk, the one of the striking things for me, Mike, in the book was this graph of the, you know, sort of exponential growth of carbon emissions since the 19th century, and in particular the last decade, the first decade of the new millennium. I mean, you know, I think people, even those who follow this debate quite closely, might think of all the sort of UN climate summits we've had and low energy light bulbs and hybrid cars, you name it, and just general awareness campaigns we've had, that would have made a difference. But it hasn't, has it, in the last decade?
No, I mean, it'd be reasonable to expect that all of the talk and action that we've heard about must have done something, surely. But yet, when you look at that curve, you don't see any detectable dent in it, not anything at all. Mm. And part of that is because if you look at the global agreements, a lot of it, there's more talk than action, you could say. But part of it is because lots of the things that we think ought to help actually don't make any difference at all. And part of that is because you've got to think of climate change as a global system. And you make a change in one place and the rest of the system is actually very capable of adapting itself to counteract that change 100%. So the UK cuts its emissions, but if it does that by importing more stuff from overseas, for example, that can completely eradicate the benefit. And if one person doesn't fly, there are all kinds of reasons why the benefit that you get at face value somehow gets absorbed. And so that's why.
I mean, a lot of that comes down to we think a lot about the point where we burn fossil fuels. If you actually think about where they come out of the ground, the whole issue becomes a lot clearer. And if you think, for example, you know, if we turn off the lights in this room, then that will, a bit less gas will be burned in a local power station. Does that mean that Gazprom in Russia is going to take less gas out of the ground? That's the key question. And unless you're confident that the answer is yes, then what you're saying is simply that gas will get used in a different way, maybe by a different sector in a different country.
It's a good point. I came away slightly from those passages thinking, well, sod it then. I'll just leave the windows open and rank the thermostat up and burn some tyres. You know, I came away slightly worrying that I don't think you're saying this because of some of the later chapters in the book, but it came away potentially feeling that you're sort of saying as individuals, or even collectively as individuals, you can't make a difference.
No, yeah, what we're saying is you can't make a direct difference, but we're emphatically saying that you can make a difference. So we don't think that taking some sort of personal action to cut your carbon emissions in itself cuts global emissions, but we do think it helps to create the conditions under which the essential things we need, like a global deal, become possible.
I mean, you write in the book, the real value of those personal actions may be less about reducing emissions directly and more about showing leadership and changing cultural norms. How valuable is that leadership that people, you know, people, as you said, you know, by me going, why have we got the lights on in this studio today? We should have, you know.
Yeah. I mean, well,
how much value does that?
It all comes down to how much human society as a whole, globally, cares about climate change. And we understand the way that global society works almost as badly as we understand the way the climate works. And we've got two massively complex systems with billions of interoperating elements. And so does it make any difference when you sort of just gradually kick up a fuss if you see some energy waste? It's impossible to know. But what you can say for sure is that if we're going to get to the point where we tackle this problem, we're going to need to constrain fossil fuels quite radically. that is going to be politically difficult. It's only going to work if enough people care about the problem enough. And if we all just go around pretending it doesn't exist, then that's not going to happen. And if we all go around seeing energy waste or whatever and just saying, well, I don't care, or it's not for me to sort it out, then you just end up with a situation where everyone agrees that there's a problem, but nobody's trying to make any practical effort to solve it. And so you do need leadership. You need to try and tip the, you know, you tip the cultural response before the climate tips on our behalf.
On a different subject, you spend a bit of time in the book writing about renewable energy, and obviously a lot of people would think that, you know, wind turbines, solar power, biomass, so on and so forth, are a big part of the solution to cutting carbon emissions. It seems to be quite intuitive. I mean, you do write with a big caveat, to be clear. We're not saying alternative energy sources aren't important in your book, but you do seem to be quite down on renewable energy and nuclear power and other forms of low carbon power.
Well, in an unconstrained world, carbon world, the trouble with renewables is that we tend to have them additionally. And the same problem goes for efficiency. Actually, in an uncarbon-constrained world, you can do all the efficiency you want, and it doesn't change or it doesn't reduce the amount of carbon that's being dug out of the ground. In fact, if you really look at it, it looks to us as though efficiency improvements are actually part of the global feedback mechanism that leads to a growth of the economy and a growth of emissions that runs with it. Mm. So... And the same goes for renewables. Now, once we get the carbon cap in place, then renewables and efficiencies will suddenly become incredibly valuable. They'll be the means by which we can have all the utility that we're used to and more. But at the moment, in the absence of that cap, no, they're not helping us.
This is interesting, though, isn't it? I mean, you sort of say in and of itself it's not helping now. But sure, I look at your graph where, you know, the emissions are going up and they reach this very tall, steep... height, and then there's a sort of lovely idyllic dotted blue line that goes down the other side of the slope. I mean, if we're to get there, and on your graph it looks like we're to get there quite soon, in a few years, even a decade, then surely we're going to need some energy when we start doing that. So surely we need to be doing getting that scale now.
The thing to understand is if you look back, there's a graph in the book that shows energy use since 1850. And what it makes really clear is that when you just think about what happened when we discovered coal. Did we stop burning wood? No, we didn't. We burned more wood, if anything. And then we discovered oil, and hey, presto, oil turned out to be great for mining machines that get more coal out. And then we built nuclear, and nuclear helped develop the economy to the extent that we had digital technologies. And hey, once you've got a computer, then it's better for extracting oil from more difficult-to-reach places. And so our book is not saying that there's anything inherently wrong with green energy. It's simply saying that if you look at it at a system level, there's some suggestion that energy begets energy. The more energy we've got, the better we are at getting all sorts of other energy out. And so there's no reason to assume that sticking up a wind turbine means that we'll burn less fuel if you look at it globally. But as you say, you know, we need to radically constrain fossil fuels. And in order to do that, we need to be building up energy sources that can substitute for them as and when we get it together to start constraining them. And that's one reason why the book says that R&D is massively important in addition to all the other ways that you can promote clean energy. We really need to be developing technologies that we can roll out as and when we start constraining the fossil fuels.
I mean, it seems on that note that the political will and energy, assuming it's a sort of finite resource, seems to be almost all focused towards technological solutions like that, and entirely not about the sort of solutions that you talk about in terms of, you know, putting a tax, say, on the production of fossil fuels or...
Well, it's not one without the other. What we're saying is that we won't get the solution without the global deal on the rate at which, or on the total amount of fossil fuel that comes out of the ground. That's absolutely essential. Once that's in place, everything around renewables and efficiency will suddenly become incredibly valuable, and there'll be how we can implement the deal without anybody suffering for it.
But I mean, I think you're absolutely right that most of the political rhetoric and the finance going into trying to tackle climate change, most of it is around what I call the good cop side of it. It's the kind of, it's creating new stuff to try and solve the problem. But when you understand it as a feedback loop, a global feedback loop, what you realize is that there's no substitute to constraining the fuels directly. And the reason that policymakers don't want to go near that is because, you know, you can tell a good political story about, oh, we're going to subsidize wind turbines and that's going to help create jobs and it's new technology and it's clean and all the rest of it. if you say to people, we as a government are going to deliberately constrain the amount of fossil fuel flowing into the economy, then you're immediately looking at higher fuel prices, you're looking at, you know, big oil companies having to write off part of their value, and of course that has knock-on effects for pension funds, and so suddenly you're up against power, and you're up against money and vested interest, and that's why politicians don't like going near it.
I want to come back to this graph just because it's so, it is so striking. A couple of things I wanted to ask about that. One is, this sort of steep, it's very rapid plateauing and then decline of emissions that we sort of hoped for if there was some sort of grand deal or grand bargain on climate change. I mean, I wondered what precedent is there in, you know, other sectors, in say population or economic wealth or any area of such a rapid U-turn on the, it just seems to me, you look at the length of the time, 150 years, and the ferocity of that growth. I just wonder where, if you think of any other examples of where there have been turnarounds like that.
I think it would be quite unprecedented. But I mean, it's worth saying all exponentials come to an end eventually. Lots of things that have been exponential are no longer exponential. Population in lots of countries is one example of that. But I think you're absolutely right. It would be an example. It would be quite a striking thing to do.
And I think the thing that's really, when you pause to think about it, it's quite scary, is that it's not as if it's not easy to understand the momentum that's continuing to drive that curve upwards. So if we'd all sort of given up on fossil fuel and we were just hoping that we could, by hook or by crook, bring it down, but there was no one trying to push it up, then we might think, okay, that feels manageable. But what's scary is if you look at, the Carbon Tracker report released last week showed that $674 billion a year is being pumped into opening up new reserves of fossil fuels that will add yet more momentum to that curve. And so it's not just that we need to turn it around fast, but we need to turn it around fast in face of direct opposition from a fossil fuel industry and its investors who are determined to increase the flow of fossil fuels out of the ground and into the air.
The other thing about the graph is you admit in the book that we'd never achieve that kind of alpine peak on the curve because such an abrupt kink would inflict mayhem on the global economy. Now, I mean, so I suppose two things come out of that really is one is if the curve keeps going up anyway, aren't we in for global mayhem anyway as we the cost of adapting to climate change? And I suppose two is if you do manage to bring things down, can the world's economic system do it without having this mayhem that you talk about?
Yeah, so there are actually, we put two graphs in the book. One of them shows a kind of rapid change, but it doesn't actually have a spike in it. And that would be a lot less painful than if you tried to put an immediate spike in. So if we tried to start reducing emissions from tomorrow, that would probably be quite painful. But putting, albeit a steep corner on it, instead, makes things easier, and there's everything to play for in terms of how in terms of the impact that has on us.
When you say easier, does that mean we have to accept that economic growth will stall or go down even, or are we talking about, I don't know, what does that mean?
We don't know. So one thing's clear is that we've never so far managed to decouple growing emissions from growing economic growth. And some people say that shows that it isn't possible. But actually, we think that's distinctly unproven because we've never put a cap on carbon. And if you did put a cap on carbon, would the economy be capable of growth? Well, we think probably yes, actually. If it's something that humankind really, really wants enough, then we'd probably be able to manage it. But there's another question about whether we're tracing the wrong metric, because it's clear that in a lot of circumstances, particularly in developed countries, actually growth is a very poor measure of well-being, and maybe it's something we've got a bit hung up on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the we go through some of the unknowns in the book about, what would... So if you just, as a thought experiment, almost say, what would happen if, all the world leaders woke up tomorrow and said, let's do a deal and we're going to constrain fuels at the rate suggested in this book and by all the scientists that we quote. And it is simply the case that we have no idea. And part of the reason that we have no idea is that it's never been tried before, so it's an untested experiment, as Mike says. But there's other reasons which come back to culture. I mean, for example, the cheapest way of creating low carbon energy in the UK is onshore wind, but people don't like it. So if you're going to try and work out the economic impact of phasing out fossil fuels, then it partly comes down to how ready we are to accept the alternatives. Are we happy to have more nuclear? You know, France built 50-odd nuclear power stations in a decade or two, and it remains a relatively low-carbon economy as a result of that. Would we support that in the UK? Probably not. Other countries? Hard to say. Would we be happy to have more onshore wind? Would we be happy to have our homes retrofitted, even if it means losing some of the nice coving we might have in them? I mean, it's all these little details about whether we embrace change, which would help determine what the economic impact would be.
There was a recent warning from the economist Lord Stern and a carbon tracker, this think tank, that we're facing a potential huge economic crash when investors wake up to the idea that fossil fuel companies can't burn all these potential reserves they have because a climate deal comes into effect and effectively, you know, writes off the value of those assets. I mean, it sounds like quite a compelling idea to me. And when we report on this, you know, there was a lot of very respectable sort of financial figures saying, yes, this is, you know, this idea has credibility. I suppose the question that strikes me on that debate is, the big question is when will this happen? I mean, you know, some people sort of talk about it such sort of a write-off or VAT factoring in coming as soon as like 2015, which is, you know, when countries will meet in Paris to potentially thrash out a climate deal. I mean, when does that happen?
Well, I mean, in terms of the economic impact, it's important to understand that the way finance flows into fossil fuels is quite complicated. There's a lot of debt involved. In order to pay off debt, you need more flows to service that debt. Fossil fuel companies already owe huge amounts of money, and the problem for them will come not because the world has suddenly done a climate deal, but because the world looks sufficiently likely to constrain fossil fuels that lenders start seeing that business model is flawed, and therefore they stop recapitalizing the debt and all that kind of stuff. So the fossil fuel companies will feel the heat way before any kind of global deal is actually signed, simply because the second it starts to look realistic, then those investments that they're currently making are going to start to seem completely irrational. But as for when a deal, you know, could or would be possible, I mean, the world has agreed to do a deal by 2015 to come in 2020. Now, the problem, as we say in the book, is that when if you actually look at the agreement, A, they haven't promised to agree anything in particular. They've just agreed to agree something. And B, although they promise that something will be related to emissions, they don't actually say that those emissions will go down in any particular country. So we really, you know, we could have a global climate deal, which still puts us well on a path to 3 or 4 degrees of warming if we don't, you know, wake up to some of the more difficult political reality that we're going to have to face.
Yeah, and just to be clear about the kind of deal that we need, because there is, you know, there is some talk that the political process is getting somewhere. But just to be really clear, it does need to be a very firm deal that really does constrain the carbon hard, and we do need it very soon. And in those terms, the political process so far is nowhere near where it needs to be at all.
I mean, in terms of waking up, I mean, you do talk in the book a lot about vested interests and you know, Duncan, and on The Guardian, you've written about the sort of correlations between countries' positions in the climate talks and the amount of carbon they have sitting beneath their borders. I mean, given the two line up quite closely, I mean, there's a nice striking factoid in an article you wrote for us about the fact that the US, China, India, Saudi Arabia, Canada and Russia, all of whom have not been particularly helpful at recent talks. They have 60% of the world's potential fossil fuel reserves. Yeah. I mean, given that, I mean, how hopeful should we be of a deal?
Well, I think we should be hopeful that it will happen at some point. I mean, what it looks increasingly unrealistic is that it will happen fast enough to avoid the worst risks. But it's important to understand that dealing with climate change is all about how lucky you're feeling. I mean, you know, we could already be heading for a global tipping point, or it could be that it, you know, we exceed what we think is a safe budget, but it turns out the climate's a bit less sensitive. It's just a matter of how risky we're feeling. And but I mean, in terms of, you know, what would it take to persuade those countries with all that fossil fuel to leave it in the ground? I mean, that's one of the things which the book looks at. And it says, for a start, you need to look much more closely at the vested interests within those countries. So you look at somewhere like the US. The US is swimming in fossil fuel money. Almost $1 billion was spent last year by fossil fuel and energy companies in the US to lobby politicians and to support their campaigns. I mean, while that is continuing to go on, it's going to be incredibly hard for those politicians to rise above those interests and say, well, hold on, we want to write off all your assets. So it's very important to look at how those power structures play and, you know, what can we do about electoral funding in the States, although obviously that's a whole can of worms in itself. The other thing I'd say is that it's about those countries that have got a lot to lose talking to each other closely. And I think, the you know, one positive piece of news that's come out in the last couple of weeks is that China and America are starting to open up bilateral talks about what's happening in the global climate negotiations, because, you know, those two countries have not quite the majority, I wouldn't have thought, but they're a huge slice of the world's coal. And, you know, if they can both say, well, we'll leave it in the ground if you do, then that's a much easier sell internally than talking to someone like the UK that has almost no fossil fuels. And they say, well, we're cutting our emissions. And they can turn around and say, well, that's great, but you don't really have anything to lose.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a bit about the vested interest at threat from capping the carbon, but it's worth making the point that actually there's also a lot of opportunity potentially. So if we look at the role of efficiency in a carbon constrained world, well, suddenly efficiency and will be the only mechanism by which it's possible to have more utility. So if your business is all about innovation and growing efficiency and is knowledge based and so on, then actually maybe that's an opportunity for you. So there may well be, and this I don't think this has ever been fully explored, but there may be at least as much business interest, for example, in having a carbon cap as there is in not having one.
But the problem is that those businesses that could have something to gain, so those businesses specializing in green energy or in efficient technologies and all those sorts of things, those businesses so far haven't really been doing a very good job of demanding political change and constraints on the fossil fuels. Yeah. And one of the things the book says is, great, you need those technologies, but because they're not enough in themselves, what you need is the whole business community, you know, whether it's supermarkets or, you know, shoe shops or anyone else, you need those businesses to collectively form a voice and demand that politicians get on with it and cap the carbon. Because otherwise, all the great stuff that they're trying to do, just like in our own lives, is likely to get cancelled out by rebound effects and the global energy feedback.
I mean, these international climate talks, they don't exist in a vacuum. I mean, you talk in the book of political paralysis and the need for public pressure to break that. I wonder what the health is of that public pressure, really. I mean, you know, just for one example, you know, there was this recent poll by GlobeScan of 12 countries showing that on pretty much every environmental indicator, from species loss to climate change, you know, public concerns at its lowest for since 1992. You know, when the first Earth Summit rolled around. I think we could probably debate whether the, you know, polls show other polls showing climate concern up, but it does feel, from sort of media coverage to activism to any of these sort of proxies, that public interest and concern isn't building on this. It feels like it's almost going the other direction.
What we need is a lot more than somebody answering a questionnaire to say, yes, I'm bothered about an issue. That's very shallow concern. What we need is really deep concern, that a politician knows that it affects how they vote. Do we need to be on the streets? Maybe that's a burning question, but it needs to be deep, deep concern.
I totally agree. Obviously, you know, it needs to go a lot further than that, but I worry that we haven't even got necessarily to the point where, you know, the number of people filling in a certain box on the questionnaire is high enough.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think, and, you know, in the book we look at a lot of, well, we look at least briefly why that might be, and we look at all the sort of psychological barriers that are in our way, things like optimism bias. So when we are faced with an uncertain future, there's a lot of evidence to show that humans almost always think things are going to turn out well. So we all think we're going to live long. We all think we're going to have a better chance than we actually have of winning the lottery. And which is how we get all our arts funding, of course, that optimism bias. And so there's all sorts of psychological barriers in our way to engaging with this issue. And the chief one, really, is that the worst impacts are in the future. So one of the things that tips the public concern a little bit is when you start to get some of the likely impacts being tangible and visible. And if you look at what happened in the States last year, where, you know, one can debate the precise degree to which it was or wasn't a result of climate change, but you've got Sandy banging into the eastern seaboard, you've got the major drought across the Midwest, and you've also got other tangible effects happening, like the collapse in sea ice. And actually, by the end of that year, there was a real measurable uptick in public concern. And actually, I think if you look at equivalent polls, there is a building concern. I mean, the one figure from a recent AXA poll suggests that 97% of people in the developing world, which of course is where the majority of the emissions now come from, now describe themselves as either concerned or very concerned about climate change. Now, as Mike says, there's a big difference between answering a question that way and writing to your politician and demanding that they sort something out. But I think there is an incremental increase in concern. But one of the things that's so sort of risky about climate change is how that will play out over the next 5-10 years depends on what the climate does. And the great danger with the climate is that whenever we wake up to it and decide that we're going to, you know, suddenly we're concerned enough, there's a lot more warming locked in just because of the inertia of the system. So somehow we need to persuade ourselves to wake up before the worst impacts have hit, because once they do, it's probably going to get worse from that point in.
Yeah, that whole mechanism of waking up, it probably isn't good enough. It's not good enough to have a mechanism that says, I don't like the weather, so I'm worried about climate change, because by the time that kicks in, you're already committed to far worse symptoms building up on you over the coming decades.
I mean, on this, I think the economic situation seems to me sort of crucial to this, because you write a lot about the links between economic growth and emissions, and the fact that, as you say, by and large, they've not become decoupled, to use the jargon. I mean, it feels to me like if you look back high water mark for a lot of interest in this stuff, 2007, it was precisely before the economic crash. And I mean, you know, there's academics, like there's a chap called Maxwell Boykoff in the States who sort of argues that we need economic growth to create the headspace, as it were, the space in public discourse to talk about climate change. I mean, do you buy, it seems like a bit of a quandary that, you know, we need economic growth to be able to care about long-term issues like climate change, and at the same time, that's the cause of climate change.
I think possibly, I don't know if you'd agree with this, Duncan, possibly the single most important thing I think that we say about economic growth is that it's an overprivileged metric. We take it too seriously, and we've been doing so for hundreds of years, and it isn't well linked to well-being, and we may or may not be able to continue economic growth in the same way. We think we probably would be able to, possibly with a hiccup of some kind, which might be able to be managed into a fairly small hiccup. But the real thing to say about it is that we're chasing the wrong metric.
But we are chasing it, unfortunately, aren't
we? We are chasing it, yeah. Partly just because of a kind of inertia and, you know, there's a lot of momentum behind it. Mm. We also chase it because, although it's obvious that GDP isn't a very good measure, when it stops growing, then there's all these side effects which are socially and politically difficult. And we need to get much better at trying to make our societies more robust so that, if economic growth does slow down, then we're less exposed to those negative side effects. One thing I was just going to pick up on your question was, you said, I know just as a shorthand that, you know, it's economic growth that's causing the problem. And one thing I hope that the book does is people talk a lot about what causes climate change. And what we're encouraging everyone to do is just remember that it's just the root cause, at least for the majority of it, is the fossil fuels themselves. So it's not that economic growth causes climate change. And, I read an Economist piece recently that said fossil fuel use is going up. That's because of economic growth. That's to misunderstand the nature of economic growth. Economic growth is caused by the availability of more energy. So, or at least to a very significant extent, and no one really understands how much. But it's not that economic growth causes climate change. It's that fossil fuels cause climate change, and we happen to have economic growth when we have more of them.
And the link between economic growth and energy has been fairly strong to date, but that doesn't mean to say it's a proven solid link in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you think of the oil crisis in the 1970s, and, of course, on the one hand, that's proof that when you constrain fossil fuels, then suddenly the economy tanks. Of course, having said that, that happened, that was a shock. I mean, that was by its nature, that was kind of suddenly an uncontrolled, unexpected constraint on the amount of oil. And so, yes, if you suddenly pull back on the amount of energy available, then that's going to have economic pain associated with it. At the same time, if you think of that same sort of thing playing out in a more measured, careful way, and you think about what happened during the oil crisis, in addition to the recession, actually money just flooded into efficiency. That's when we invented plastics recycling. It's when France built all its nuclear. It's, you know, it's,
that White House put solar on the roof.
White House put solar on the roof. Exactly. So, you know, if we had a more managed constraint on fossil fuel over a few years, gradually starting to pull it back, you know, that throttle would inject a huge amount of effort and innovation and expertise going into alternatives. And no one knows yet how successful those alternatives would be in scaling up.
And we talk about lots of technologies being quite a long way off: carbon capture and storage, sequestration, maybe even soil carbon capture, various efficiencies. We talk about them being a long way off. But if we really were very serious about this, you know, to use the analogy, if we were on a war footing about this, then it's very likely that all those technologies would arrive far faster than we currently predict.
Okay. The challenge is, how do we get off fossil fuels? And you outline at the end of the book six possible steps to tackling this and in turn climate change. One of those is cap and trade, this idea of putting a limit and then trading permits or whatever. And another is geoengineering, this idea of, you know, interfering with the planet's either taking carbon directly out of the air or stopping warmth getting into the planet in the first place. I mean, out of the steps that you outline, I mean, which holds the most promise, do you think, out of the six that you talk about?
It would be wonderful to find ways of taking the carbon back out of the air. So carbon capture and storage gets us some of that, starts to take some of the carbon out of fossil fuel as we burn it. But if we could take it out of ambient air in any way, either through carbon scrubbing or through some kind of agricultural technique, if that were possible, that would be, if there's a silver bullet out there, and there probably isn't, but if there was one, that would be fantastic, because we could take out historical emissions, theoretically.
Obviously, we'd have to overcome a lot of fears over geoengineering of sort of, you know.
Well, that's the least invasive end of geoengineering. So there are some
There's even a case saying it's un-geo. It's geo unengineering. It's because it's removing something. We're having this experiment. We're engineering the climate by doubling the amount of CO2 in it.
Yeah.
And it's just saying, well, let's not do that.
Well, so it's waste management.
Exactly. And I don't know if you saw the recent TED talk by Alan Savory. I mean, that's one thing that we flag up as something that looks like it could hold huge potential, very much unproven at the moment at the scale that he talks about. But
can you just explain what he...
This idea, this is an agricultural scientist who has spent years trying to work out how to turn desertified, damaged, degraded, arid land into rich pasture land again. And his principal aim for doing that is restoring the land, bringing back the ecosystems. But it has this amazing side effect that if it works, then it pulls a huge amount of carbon from the sky and stores it safely in the soil. And his principal means of achieving this is by using cattle in a way that mimics wild herds, so that they nurture the land. You know, there's a very sort of there's a very two-way relationship between herd and land, where the herd keeps the grass low but also fertilizes the land and the rest of it. So that's an example of there may be a way to get carbon out of the air which is not expensive and has an amazing side benefit in terms of ecosystems and food productions and the rest of it. To answer your question, which of these six steps is the key one? I mean, we deliberately put waking up as number one, because all the stuff that follows, the chance of it happening goes up proportionally with how bothered we are about climate change.
Just one last question. If I was, or our readers were to just take away one thing, one idea from this book, what would it be for each of you?
I think it would be get real about how much progress is or isn't being made and make it a political priority. I mean, you know, we're hosting the G8 talks this year. We're in the UK. We like to think of ourselves as a global leader on climate change. Is climate change on the agenda? Absolutely not. I mean, that for me is an example of how that's a way in which people in the UK, by making it more of an issue, could have forced it onto the world stage. But we're not making it a political issue. We're not demanding that our politicians do more. And so they're not.
And for me, perhaps it's leadership. So there's a massive leadership vacuum. And what does leadership look like and where does it come from? Actually, it comes from absolutely everywhere. It doesn't come from just from the top, doesn't come just from the bottom. It comes from all of us in all the walks of our life, in whatever roles we have. And it's about finding the bits that you can see how to do.
A huge thanks to Duncan Clark and Mike Berners-Lee. The Burning Question is published by Profile Books in softback and available now in all on and offline bookshops. We'll have links and information about the authors on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And of course, for the most up-to-date and in-depth coverage of everything green, go to environmentguardian.co.uk. That's all for this week, but from me, Adam Vaughan, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.